Shri Yamaraj said, "Alas, how amazing it is. These persons, who are older than me, have full experience that hundreds and thousands of living entities have taken birth and died. Thus they should understand that they are also apt to die. Yet still they are bewildered. The conditioned soul comes from an unknown place and returns after death to that same unknown place. There is no exception to this rule, which is conducted by material nature. Knowing this, why do they uselessly lament?" Purport by His Divine Grace, Sri Bhaktivedanta Swamiji Prabhupada. The Lord says in Bhagavad Gita 2:28, "All living beings are unmanifest in the beginning, manifest in the interim state, and unmanifest again when they are annihilated. So what need is there for lamentation?" Accepting that there are two classes of philosophers, one believing in the existence of the soul and the other not believing in its existence, there is no cause for lamentation in either case. Non-believers in the existence of the soul are called atheists by followers of Vedic wisdom. Yet even if, for argument's sake, we accept the atheistic theory, there is still no cause for lamentation. Apart from the separate existence of the soul, the material elements remain unmanifested before creation. From the subtle state of unmanifestation comes manifestation. Just as from ether, air is generated. From air, fire. From fire, water is generated. From water, earth becomes manifested. From the earth, many varieties of manifestations take place. For example, a big skyscraper is manifested from the earth. When it is dismantled, the manifestation becomes again unmanifested and remains as atoms in the ultimate stage. The law of conservation of energy remains, but in the course of time, things are manifested and unmanifested. That is the difference. And what causes there for lamentation in either manifestation or unmanifestation? Somehow or other, even in the unmanifested stage, things are not lost. But at the beginning and at the end, all elements remain unmanifested, and this does not make any real material difference. If we accept the Vedic conclusion as stated in Bhagavad Gita, that these material bodies are perishable in due course of time, but that the soul is eternal, then we must remember always that the body is like a dress. Therefore, why lament the changing of the dress? The material body has no factual existence in relation to the eternal soul. It is something like a dream. In a dream, we may think of flying in the sky or sitting on a chariot as a king. But when we wake up, we can see that we are neither in the sky nor seated on the chariot. The Vedic wisdom encourages self-realization on the basis of the non-existence of the material body. Therefore, in either case, whether one believes in the existence of the soul or one does not believe, there is no cause for lamentation for the loss of the body. Om Adhyanatana Mantasya Gnanjana Sarakaya Chakshwaramadata Tasma Shri Gurave Nama Shri Shaitamina Navastam Stapitamina Bhutara Swayam Rapa Kadama Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama. Yamarasha. Alas, how amazing it is. These persons, who are older than me, have full experience the hundreds and thousands of living entities have taken birth and died. Thus they should understand that they are also apt to die. Yet still they are bewildered. The conditioned soul comes from an unknown place and returns after death to that same unknown place. There is no exception to this rule, which is conducted by material nature. Knowing this, why do they uselessly acknowledge? In this verse, Sri Yamaraj is explaining, and Srila Prabhupada continually repeats over and over in this same purport the same theme, that whether we believe in the eternal existence of the soul as separate from the body, or we don't believe in the existence of the soul at all, in either case, there is no point in lamenting the death of the body, which is inevitable. And Yamaraj is exclaiming his amazement to these queens who are so bereaved, so bewildered and overcome with lamentation at the death of their husband, that they're clinging, grasping his body so tightly and so desperately that they will not even allow it to be cremated at the appropriate time. And therefore, their poor husband is hovering as a ghost, unable to move on to his next destination. And he himself is so lamenting the loss of his body, he's trying to hold on to it himself, although he's already lost it. So he's in a state of limbo, unable to move on, largely due to the false attachment and intense lamentation of the queens, which is very much inhibiting the progress of the soul of their husband, who, out of misplaced so-called love, are clinging to his outward dress, his deceased body. So, in this chapter, we are repeatedly reminded of the use, not only the uselessness, but actually the obstruction in spiritual, and in any progress, especially spiritual progress, caused by lamentation. This is useless. But this should not be confounded with mourning, which is appropriate and actually helps the soul to move on. Jesus said, "Blessed are those who mourn." Well, actually, he began by saying, "Blessed are those who are poor in spirit, for theirs will be the kingdom of God." And what he said is that to experience the heights of spiritual achievement, we need to enter into the depths of spiritual poverty. And we see, practically speaking, in people's struggles and challenges along the path from this world, they find the courage and resolve to move onward when their despair is deepest and their energy and life is nearly extinguished. And this is very graphically demonstrated in the great transformation in the life of Kali, when, due to the blessed touch of Krishna's lotus feet, was vomiting all the flames and poison and fire and anger and wrath. And when that was all extricated, he was vomiting blood, which meant that he was going through a kind of death. There's other kinds of death than just the death of the material body. There's the death of our hopes, the death of our dreams, and hopefully the death of our false ego, which is why all the Vaishnava acharyas emphasize that we must die in order to live. And this means that we find actual life when the false ego dies. And with the death of the false ego, our actual identity is Jivarasvarupaya, Nityare Krishnadas, awakens. But the death of the different phases of life to which we're so bitterly attached is not really properly concluded without the stage of mourning, which comes in different ways according to different cultures and different beliefs. Like in some cultures, they mourn the death of a loved one by festivities, singing and dancing. And they think that just to sit around and cry is very selfish, because it's very self-centered. And you're not thinking of the possibilities for advancement to the life of your beloved. That, you know, death is a kind of closing of one door and the opening of another, hopefully to a better life. So we should not confound lamentation, which is unhealthy in every instance, with mourning, which really means acknowledging that yes, something is lost. We were attached to something that gave us something of use in its time, but now it's obsolete. And to stay stuck in the past to the extent that we cripple and disable ourselves from moving into the future is a sure formula for disaster, emotionally, spiritually, everywhere. So mourning means, yes, we're not going to be in denial. We're going to acknowledge that something which was precious to us at one time is lost. And it's also obsolete. So close that chapter. Put it to rest so that you can open the next chapter of life and enter into it. And that's why renunciation is so much emphasized. And the life of Raghunath Das Thakur is the most beautiful illumination of the principle of renunciation, which sustains the lives of the devotees of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So what is the renunciation in the life of Raghunath Das Goswami? When he wanted to run off with Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the Lord told him, no, stay at home. Act like a pounds and shillings man. Do your household duties responsibly. And in course of time, Krishna will make all arrangements. So you see the life of Raghunath Das Goswami beginning from following that instruction of being a dutiful householder. And in that stage, he was actually very instrumental in assisting his father and uncle in their spiritual progress by protecting them from so much danger from which Raghunath Das Goswami delivered them by his expertise and management. But then, when he so much pleased Lord Nityananda by service to his devotees, Lord Nityananda blessed him and predicted that the grace of the Lord, which is more powerful than anything, will extricate you from all your entanglements, set you free. The Lord will place you in the care. Place your hand in the hand of his most loving associate, Sri Swarup Damodar, and you will become his intimate associate. And we know how the stages of renunciation progressed. When Raghunath Das, even in Puri, was receiving wealth from his family members, which he was using to serve Mahaprabhu. And then at a certain stage, he was thinking, Mahaprabhu is not pleased. I mean, taking all this wealth and using it in his service. So he renounced that and lived by begging. And then he was thinking that by begging, I'm being like a prostitute. I can't be impartial because I'm prejudging everyone who comes as far as what I might get from them. And this is unchaste. So he gave up begging and he lived just by what came of his own accord. And then he was thinking that that also was being very greedy and selfish. And he began living by the reject compost that even the cows, the Jagannath Puri cows, which are famous for eating just about anything, what they rejected was his sustenance. And we know how Mahaprabhu came and he grabbed some of that decomposed rice and forcefully took it from Jagannath and said that even though I eat 56 offerings a day here in Puri, and I'm served by millions of Vaishnavas everywhere in the creation, this is so delicious. He tried to grab more and then he said, "God, I stopped him. This is not meant for you." And then later on, when that one devotee who was so attached to Raghunath Das Goswami was giving him just like a few spoonfuls of buttermilk every day, and he was sustaining his life on that. And all the time condemning himself. That when one's heart has been purified by actual knowledge of the soul, he has no right continuing to act like a debauchee, serving with such care his material body. So what Raghunath Goswami is beautifully illustrating is the rhythm of renunciation which keeps our spiritual lives progressive. There's a rhythm to life, a natural rhythm, which is supposed to lead us to the purpose of human life, which is to, first of all, question, why am I here? Why am I suffering? And what is the purpose of it all? If we do not progress in renunciation, and by renunciation, I mean what is proper for your particular season in life. There's four basic seasons to human life, as there's four seasons to a year. You know, youth is meant for developing the body with vigor, for perpetuation of the species through marriage and offspring, which makes the individual whole by their contribution to society. But the problem is, if we do not progress in renunciation through the different stages in varnas, in ashrams, we get stuck in whatever circumstances we find some temporary relief and or pleasure and lose the impetus to progress in spiritual life. And then what happens? Stagnancy. Stagnation. We start to think that our family members are eternal. This wife, these children are my eternal associates. Which is an illusion. And keeps us anchored and bound and shackled in material existence. A self-defeating, disempowered attachment which inhibits the very purpose of human life, which is spiritual achievement. So Jesus said, "Blessed are those in poor in spirit," because by Krishna's wonderful, merciful arrangement, whenever we become stagnant in our spiritual life, that initial dissatisfaction begins to fester in the heart. It finds relief in varieties of whatever, but cannot be relieved by anything but spiritual nourishment, meaning reciprocation from loving devotees who convey the Lord's love to us, for which we have a responsibility to convey the Lord's love in return to others. And when devotees are actually conveying Krishna's love to one another, they'll never become dissatisfied or discouraged. Their lives will remain dynamic and vibrant. They won't get stuck in the muck of material existence. So, the problem that challenges us all at times is denial on different stages and levels, but ultimately denial of our inner longings. So, mourning acknowledges our own feelings. It enables us to experience the full range of emotions. And confronting the worst in us, the anarthas, the attachments, allows us and helps us to revere the best in us. So, mourning. Jesus said, blessed are those who mourn, because they will be comforted. And how does the comfort come? In change. In letting go of the past with all its illusions and attachments which anchor our lives from moving upwards and onward in spiritual life. Mourning means to close a chapter in order to open the next. It's natural that we feel sad over what we leave behind as we grow. And by mourning, we acknowledge that the changes are real and we're serious about growing and healing. But change requires sacrifice. Sacrifice of our attachments. And it's amazing to see how people are so deeply attached to their suffering that they will not let it go. Why is this? Because our attachment to personal pain, to which we are so prone to cling, means that with which we're so familiar. And the jiva has a natural fear of the unknown. Because jiva means infinitesimal by nature. We need protection. We need shelter. And we're afraid to enter into the unknown. And we're more prone to retreat into past nostalgia, which, although obsolete and unable to meet our present needs, is very familiar to us. And by confronting our attachments, we're able to give up our confining, disempowering, crippling propensities and make a move or a leap of faith. And that faith to move onward into unknown realms is cultivated by hearing. Hearing every day the message of the Srimad Bhagavatam, which reminds us with unlimited episodes from pastimes like that of Prahlad, who even though hurled off a high cliff, was faithful in the loving hands of his Lord, which would catch him as he fell and lead him as he moved onward. So Srila Prabhupada emphasized that we can learn much about Krishna from the feelings in our fellow travelers on the path. We see there is an inherent goodness and kindness and loving propensity in every living entity, because they're part and parcel of Krishna. They're a reflection of his nature, although covered over, but still as long as the spirit soul is present in the body, is attractive because it teaches us and reveals to us something about Krishna. And their kindness and caring reflects the quality of the nature of our source, Sri Krishna. So, therefore, it's natural to feel sad when someone in our lives who taught us something about Krishna, when they leave and go elsewhere, it's natural to feel sad. It's proper to mourn, but we have to acknowledge that our lessons have to progress if we're to graduate from the school of life. Srila Lochan Das Thakur tells us in Chaitanya Mangal that there's one story which, if you hear it, will mitigate all the miseries in the heart. It's a pastime which is so deeply touching and heartrending, which Vrindavan Das Thakur just gracefully said, I can't explain this well. He just alluded to the departure of Jagannath Mishra. But Lochan Das Thakur gave little information. And he said, the potency in this pastime will mitigate all the miseries in our hearts. And he explained how actually, this is like a sequel to a previous dream, not too far before this pastime, in which Jagannath Mishra, just after completing his mourning for the loss of Vishwarup, which threw all of Nadia into mourning, because Vishwarup just brought Krishna consciousness to life in the hearts and the lives of all the devotees. He was so renounced. He was so kind and loving and compassionate and just always talking about Krishna and bringing Krishna to life in the lives of the devotees. And when he took sannyas, he was such a heart-rending blow to everyone in Nadia, even the atheists and non-believers. They felt very deeply the anguish of separation from that great soul who brought them Krishna. And Jagannath Mishra and Mother Sachi were in such a deep state of mourning that Nimai, who was previously very mischievous, just like Gopal Krishna, became very sober. And he was always at the side of his parents to console them. And by his personal loving presence and touch on every level of their lives, they moved through their mourning into an openness with faith for whatever life had held from there on. And then, just when his mourning was completed for that tremendous loss, Jagannath Mishra had a dream. It was so traumatic that Mother Sachi woke in the middle of the night to hear her husband crying in great anguish, oh Krishna, don't take away my Nimai. Just let him stay with the family. Mother Sachi was so shocked. Why are you crying like this? And Mishra said, I just had a dream which has filled me with horror and reverence and awe. In my dream, I saw our child Nimai with his head shaved completely clean. And paradoxically, he was so beautiful in the garb of a sannyasi. His beautiful form like molten gold, dressed in saffron cloth, with upraised arms, leading all the devotees in big Mahaharinam Sankirtan, taking all the devotees to Navadvip in proceeding through the countryside, delivering everyone with the holy name of Krishna as he proceeded in his journey to Nilachala. And this dream has filled me with wonder and awe that we might also lose our other son, who is our very life and soul. And then a very interesting thing happened. Because, see, usually it was the other way around. Mother Sati was always in anxiety about losing her son. And Jagannath Mishra would pacify her with transcendental wisdom. And here we find a reversal. That Jagannath Mishra was just completely losing his composure. But to Mother Sati, she could not even entertain the possibility. It was completely out of the question. And she told her husband that, no, he won't leave home. He's too attached to his studies. She just could not possibly entertain the thought of the possibility of his taking sannyas. And therefore, she wasn't the least bit in anxiety. And seeing her confidence, Jagannath Mishra was somewhat pacified. But the traumatic effect never really left him. And it culminated in his return from the ashram of his guru one day, when, coming back home, he suddenly burst out in this very high burning fever and just became somewhat delirious. And Mother thought she was just frantic. It looked like she was going to lose her husband. And she was just frantically crying and pleading. And then Nimai said, Mother Sachi, this is a very crucial time, a very critical time. And then he first preached to her a little bit. Everyone in this world must die, be he Brahma or Shiva or the Himalayas or the vast oceans. They all must perish in time. That's a given. But the important thing is that at that crucial, critical juncture, when the soul is leaving his body for his next destination, it is the utmost duty of friends and loved ones to help him progress by reminding him of Krishna. So, little Nimai, he took charge of the family affairs at this time and told Mother Sachi, don't delay. Gather all the friends and relatives, which she did, and everyone came running and saw that he was about to leave his body. And they all, on the encouragement of little Nimai, immersed themselves in Harinam Sankirtan. And then, as they carried his body to the Ganges, little Nimai was clutching his father's feet and crying with uncontrolled emotion, and a voice choked up, saying, Father, are you going to leave me behind all alone? Am I going to be bereft of the privilege of calling out, Father? And the thought that you're going to leave me behind makes the house look empty in all 10 directions, overcast with darkness. And who's going to hold my hand and lead me and teach me and chastise me? And it was such a heart-rending scene. And then Jagannath Mishra spoke his last words. He said, Nimai, I need to tell you what is in my heart, that you may forget me someday, and therefore all I can do is submit you to the lotus feet of Raghunath, the family, Shalimar, Shiva. And then closing his eyes and immersing himself in an internal mood of preparation, Jagannath Mishra quit this world and was uplifted in the celestial chariot to Vaikuntha. And then Sati Mata just lost in grief. She was crying so piteously, my husband, how can you leave me behind? The Lord has already taken away my elder son. Now he's taken away my husband, you're leaving me behind after I've served you in sleeping, in waking, in all conditions of life. You're just forsaking me and leaving me with this little child to raise on my own. And how can you leave him without an orphan, practically, with no father? And such his words just intensified everyone's grief to the point that little Nimai was just crying so profusely that his chest was bedecked with teardrops which glittered like pearls. And seeing him cry, everyone else forgot their lamentation and told him, little Nimai, if you cry, the whole creation is going to suffer. And then they told Mother Sachi, why are you lamenting? Look at your son. You still have him. What need is there to lament? And looking in the eyes of her son, she found that she had all the protection and shelter she would ever need. So, then Nimai himself performed the funeral rites and led everyone in the process of mourning, letting go of their beloved associate, and imbibing the lessons they learned from him in their lives, moving on into life's next lessons. And the next dramatic lesson we have in this regard of death and dying is in the house of Srivastakura. When one night the ladies were grieving so loudly that it was brought to the attention of Srivastakura that his only son was on the verge of death. And he went running into the room where his son lay dying, surrounded by all these Matajis who were grieving so loudly that he was afraid the Lord would hear and it would disturb his kirtan. So Srivastakura explained the basic spiritual truths to those Matajis, and then he told them, if you do not quiet down your wailing, then I'm going to throw myself in the Ganges and you'll really have a cause to lament. So just keep your mourning a little bit quiet and subdued so that the Lord's kirtan, which is the only life for any and all of us, is not disturbed. So Srivas went back in, joined in the kirtan. And that kirtan, as typical, his son, he died right about sunset. And they just immersed themselves in kirtan throughout the whole night. But one by one, the different associates came to learn that Srivas's only son has just died. And they would look at Srivas, and he was just dancing with upraised arms, chanting out in great enthusiasm for the shelter and mercy of the Lord, calling upon his holy name. And they would look at Lord Gauranga, and he did not seem to be aware. But gradually the devotees, one by one, were becoming affected by the grief of the passing away of Srivas's only son, with the only exception being Srivas and Mahaprabhu himself. And then Mahaprabhu stopped the kirtan. He said, something is not right. Has any calamity overcome this household? And Srivas said, how could there be any calamity in a house where you personally are leading the kirtan? And then someone informed the Lord, well, actually, his only son just died. Not just died, died at sunset. And it's now almost sunrise. And the Lord said, why didn't you tell me? He said, we were afraid that would interfere with the kirtan. And then a very interesting event transpired. The Lord broke down in tears and began, actually, he was lamenting. He began lamenting. How could I leave such loving associates?
and began crying.
And then he went into the boy, into the room where the boy lay dead,
and said, "Why are you leaving the house of Shiva's Thakur, such a great exalted soul?"
And the boy sat up and said, "My stay in this house is over. I've come to this house and stayed as a guest as long as you've ordained, and now, according to your will, I'm moving on. So please bless me, that wherever I go, I will never forget your lotus feet." And then the boy again lay down dead. Lord Chaitanya looked at Srivast Thakur and told him, "You just lost your only son, but Nitai and I are your eternal sons, and we will never, ever leave you in happiness and sorrow in this life or the next." And then the next tremendous lesson in mourning was when Nimaya Pandit concluded that the nectar he had brought to revive the living entities from their comatose state had turned, by the dint of their own lack of acceptance and appreciation, into the deadly poison. They thought, "The only way I can correct the situation is by taking sannyas." As such, he came to learn of this. She became like a corpse. He was preaching to her the science of the soul, and that did not work for Matasachi. She became so pale and emaciated, just like skin and bones. So he saw that philosophy is not going to work to console her. So then he began revealing some intimate truth of loving relationships. He said, "Matasachi." Actually, he told all the devotees that, "I will forever be present with all of you in Sankirtan." In two ways, in Harinam Sankirtan and in the joy we experience as serving the deities. In those two forms, you can understand that I will always be present with you. And when she was pleading with her Nimai that, "I've lost your elder brother, I've lost your father, and now I'm losing you," it was just exactly like Kaushalya pleading with Ram not to go. And then seeing that Mother Sachi was actually going to die by the grief of separation from her son, he explained to her that eternally, through so many lives, I've always been your son. When you were Aditi, I became Vamana. When you were Devahuti, I became Kapila for your pleasure. And you were Devaki, I became your child, Krishna. But you are going to receive a special blessing in this life because you will be my mother in two forms now. As the earth goddess, you are the mother of my deity. And as the devotees, you are the mother of my holy name. My two forms have one mother. And in this way, from now on, you are my mother in two different ways. Mother of my deity form and mother of the congregation chanting of the holy name. So we see in the lives of the devotees there are tears, there is grief, there is pain of separation, there is fear of separation, and there are tears flowing like torrents of rain. But the tears of the devotees are, although superficially looking similar, are categorically different from those of non-devotees. The tears of the Nandamunis are expressions of their aversion to Krishna. And it just makes the heart even harder. The tears of the devotees are expressions for their love for Krishna. And their willingness to do anything for Krishna. And their desire only to see the pleasure of Krishna. And Srila Prabhupada said a wonderful thing in one lecture. He said that all the pain and anguish we suffer in this world does not compare to the pain that Krishna feels on our behalf. The pain, the anguish that Krishna feels for the loss of one of his children is greater than the pain and suffering we experience in our long history of forgetfulness of Krishna. And with that understanding, wanting at least to relieve the pain and anguish. And Srila Prabhupada also explained his own version of the prodigal son. He said, Krishna is more concerned about the children who have left than the ones who are safely at home in his loving shelter. He's more concerned about them, about their plight in this material sojourn. And this instruction that Srila Prabhupada was giving in this regard is revealed by Sanatana Goswami in his Brihad Bhagavatamrita. When Gopakumar attained the shelter of the Lord of Vaikuntha, and Lord Narayan explained to him that you have passed many lifetimes without paying any attention to me, but I never forgot you. And Lord Narayan said, there was a hope that kept me dancing like a fool. This hope that someday, in some life, you would again turn to me. But for so many lives, you did not turn to me. You did not even call upon my name. And I've been waiting so patiently. When will that day, when will that life come? Then my beloved child will again turn to me and call to me to take him home. So Lord Narayan explained to Gopakumar that for so many lives I could find no pretext to break my timeless laws not to interfere with the free will of the jiva who is trying to enjoy and control independent of me. He explained that when the jiva is trying to act as an independent enjoyer or controller, my own timeless laws is I will not personally interfere. I will leave him to the mercy of the Vedas and the Vaishnavas. And when by their imploring he calls upon my name, even Namabhas, as in the case of Ajamiya, then when he calls upon my name, even indirectly, even unconsciously, even meaning something else, then I take direct personal intervention in his life. So then the Lord said, for so many lives, you have not shown me any mercy. And thereby you have just been increasing my anxiety by staying away from home for so long. But I cannot transgress my own codes of conduct and directly interfere. I had to wait until the mercy of the Vedas and the mercy of the Vaishnavas inspired me to call upon my holy name. And then, when you finally did, I took personal intervention in your life, and I arranged for you to take birth on Govardhan Hill. And it was I who came to you as your guru, Jayanta. So the Lord continued speaking to Gopakumara, that today my long cherished desire that you come home has at last been fulfilled. And even though I never did any good for you, you have now done the greatest good for me by coming home. But still, Gopakumara, because he saw the Lord of Vaikuntha enjoyed his pastimes of herding cows, but then there was this dichotomy that he was also sitting on the throne in the palaces of Dwarka. And thus Gopakumara's deepest heartfelt desire for pure, unobstructed love, unobstructed by any type of distance caused by reverence, he could not find complete satisfaction in Vaikuntha. So, by the instructions and the inspiration of the devotees, when he finally returned to Goloka, and everyone was so amazed. The gopas and gopis were just amazed. Then when this newcomer entered into their midst, someone they'd never seen before, Krishna just ran, forgetting everyone else, and embraced this newcomer to Goloka. And Krishna began crying. How could you have stayed away for so long? I know how much you suffered. You were searching everywhere, and you were mistreated, and you suffered, and you cried, and I was with you the whole time, but you would not acknowledge me until now that you finally come home. So these pastimes reveal the deep anguish the Lord feels. How can he who is Satchidananda Vigraha be tormented with pain and anguish at the loss of a child? Philosophically, it does not make any sense. He's atmaram, he's self-satisfied. But beyond the realization of sat, the eternality of the soul, and chit, the knowledge of the soul, is the ananda, which is born of loving relationships. And ultimately, the great wealth and opulence of Vrindavan is its loving relationships. So we should not become overwhelmed by our selfish desires and our selfish indulgences and self-pity due to frustrations of our selfish desires in this world. Krishna consciousness means we become conscious of Krishna and his desires and his will. And when he says in Bhagavad Gita, there is no one so dear, nor will there ever be anyone so dear as he who explains this science to others, Krishna is revealing his own heart. Krishna is repeatedly coming to this world. He's repeatedly, continually, forever, sending his representatives, coming himself, leaving the scriptures to teach us how to progress back home, back to Godhead. And when we understand how fervently Krishna is desiring that his lost children come home, then our natural, proper response should be to practice the principles of Krishna consciousness very strictly, very sincerely, very soberly, and with great humility, imploring the mercy of the Lord, and with great compassion, which is the essential companion of love for Krishna, try to help others for Krishna's pleasure to find their way out of this world of suffering and grief back
to that, to our homeland. We're all walking transforms into dancing, or communication transforms into song, or Krishna's flute is always calling, and time is conspicuous by its absence. It all begins with taking the order of Sri Guru as our life and soul, and by taking to heart the instructions to chant the holy name with forbearance like that of a tree, with humility like that of the straw in the street. When that holy name takes root in our heart, then gradually, from the seed of the holy name, as that seed of the Bhakti Lata Bija sprouts and begins to grow, gradually, the Lord's qualities, pastimes, and the spiritual world will blossom in our meditation until that happy day when we finally please the Lord by completing all our lessons and passing all our tests, especially the ultimate test of death, and finally achieving the goal and purpose of life, which is to go back home, back to Godhead. Not so much for our own relief, but for the pleasure and satisfaction of the Lord. Thank you very much. Are there any questions or comments? We have a tendency to think that our companions are eternal. In some cases it may be true, but not in all cases. Our association consists of devotees who will be with us on our path and with us in our goal, but we have all kinds of associations in this world. Some of those associates are not really sincerely interested in going back to Godhead. So our attachment should not be cultivated with them, because that will not help us on our path back home. Our attachment should... We should develop attachment with devotees who are sincerely inspired and interested in the same goal of going back home. And that association may be eternal. May or may not be. It may be. So I didn't say all our associates may be temporary. Some of them may be eternal. But the illusion we have to protect ourselves from falling into is that those who by karma come into our lives, we mistake to be our eternal associates. Some of the associates in our life may be eternal associates. We don't know at this point. We should not assume that those who come as family members and friends and associates in our practical dealings in life are necessarily our eternal companions. In most cases, they're not. But in some cases, they may be.
Is there any pastime where Krishna shed tears? Krishna cried?
There's unlimited pastimes where Krishna cried. We just heard a number of them regarding Lord Gauranga.
Yes. Yes. Krishna.
It's not so common with Krishna as it is with Lord Gauranga. Read the pastime of the passing away of Bhishma and see what was Krishna's response. See what he says.
if he was crying there. Yeah, he cried and Mother Yashoda was chasing him. But those were described as being false tears. Sati Ratamuni says, let these pastimes be continually enacted within my heart. Okay, you can say it's false tears, but did he still cry? He is pleading with Mother Yashoda. First of all, he confessed. Yeah, I did it. He confessed. Just like a criminal before a high court judge, thinking if he confessed, he might get some mercy. He confessed, yes, I did it. Please don't punish me. Yeah, he was crying. It's out of fear. But really out of love. Yes, Krishna is crying. Out of fear. Out of love. Out of Yashoda. Anything else?
We're not supposed to desire liberation yet. We're desiring to go back to home, back to Ganya, and you said for the pleasure, for pleasing Krishna. And it's like the subtle, it's kind of a real subtle part of life between.
Well, first of all, there's different kinds of liberation. There's merging into the Brahma Jyoti, which is not pleasing to Krishna. So that kind of liberation is condemned for Vaishnavas and by Vaishnavas. And we should not desire to go back to Godhead just for our own relief from material suffering, because that's also selfish. But Srila Prabhupada said we should desire to go back to Godhead, because if we try to artificially impose the higher standard of just being willing to do anything for Krishna, or like Vasudeva Tata, willing to stay and suffer in this world forever so that others can benefit and go back home, that's artificial in our state. That's for someone with the unlimited compassion of God as manifest in the heart of his loving, intimate servant, Vasudeva Tata. So Srila Prabhupada said, we should desire to go back to Godhead, because he knew of our complacent nature to half-heartedly practice Krishna consciousness and be quite willing to just stay here forever. We want to be relieved of the suffering, but we don't really want to get out of the material world because we still have attachments. So that being our nature in neophyte condition, Srila Prabhupada said we should desire to go back to Godhead. But the higher understanding is that we should not desire to go back to Godhead just as just for relief. You can't go back to Godhead for relief. You wouldn't be happy there. Nobody attains Goloka out of a desire for relief from material sufferings. And if they did, by some special concession, they would not be happy. They'd be more miserable there than they would in the spiritual world. Because there, everyone is pure. They act only for the pleasure of Krishna. There are no selfish attachments or ambitions. If one achieved that destination as a reward for his desire for relief or liberation, he would be more miserable than he would be here. And he'd make everyone else miserable too. The spiritual world is so wonderful because there is no tinge of selfish desire in anyone's heart, or possibility that there ever would be. So we should not desire to go back to Godhead with these mixed motives that we tend to carry in our hearts. So Srila Prabhupada encouraged, we have to desire to go back to Godhead just to clarify in our own hearts that we want to free ourselves from the attachments that keep us here.
We have to qualify and purify those desires that it be only for Krishna's pleasure, not for our own selfish ambition to achieve relief from the sufferings of material nature. Okay?
But how is it Krishna's pleasure?
That's what we're just talking about. He misses his lost children. He's longing, he's feeling for their plight. He's longing for their return. He's feeling anguish and anxiety for them. So to relieve him of that anxiety and to offer him some pleasure, we should purify ourselves and qualify ourselves and go home for his pleasure. Don't parents like to have their children come home, especially when they're lost in some crazy distant land, out of their minds, doing all kinds of dangerous, treacherous things? Aren't the parents happy to have them come home and take shelter? Of course, there's different ways of being lost. The prodigal son story tells of one son who was lost in a distant land, where he finally came to the conclusion it would be better to be a servant in my father's house than a lord of this foreign land. And he came home. The father was so overjoyed and had a big festival. But the son who never left home didn't want to come to the festival, because he was lost at home when his brother was lost in a different land. And he was the more stubborn of the two. It also indicates the Pharisee, who's so good at the rules and regulations, but never really comes to the proper conclusion. So Krishna wants us home for his pleasure and relief. We should comply with all the arrangements he makes to help us. And not give him... Or as little Nimai told Murari Gupta, why are you hurting Krishna by not surrendering? He said that to Murari. Why are you hurting Krishna by not surrendering? So that tells us something about the loving heart of the Lord. Thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.
Somebody is like, okay, I'm going to give you an example. Like yesterday, working in the greenhouse, and I get chastised in an unfair, abusive way. What's the difference between humility and accepting, you know, just being humble and then continuing, okay, well, even though it was abusive and unfair and you know, should I continue just to ignore that and just
as
work?
As I've said so many times, we have an equal duty to humility as we do to truth. If something's not right, we have the duty to explain it in a detached way, to appeal to the person's higher nature. You know, why don't we behave that way?
And if that person ignores, chooses to ignore that, then you should protect yourself.
With humility.
With humility, yeah. But not to allow yourself to be continually put in that position, not to go back the next day when that person
well,
has not...
Well, you don't want to encourage it,
right.
Or perpetuate
it. Right.
But ultimately, you know, you don't have direct control over another's actions. Your best control over their actions is your own responses.
Right.
If you get angry, defensive, or reactive, you're usually forcing, conditioning. Whereas if you, in a detached way, explain that this is not proper, you'll be humble and detached about it. And then you've done your duty both to truth and humility, which are just different phases of the same element.
Okay, thank you. Okay, you can have
your friend.
Is that good?
Maharaj, I just wanted to ask a question. Maharaj, you were stressing about the progress in renunciation.
Love.
Progress in renunciation. Much for sannyasi and a brahmachari, it's accepting the order of life. So it's natural for them to renounce. But for grihasthas, as they get married and they have offspring, start collecting things. And also, pretty much, I mean, personally, I can say there is attachment. And if you see in ISKCON all over, even people are 50 plus, they are still in the, I mean, they are staying in grihastha ashram, but they have not accepted the vanaprastha life. Could you comment on this, Maharaj?
You covered quite a number of issues in that question.
What is that, Maharaj?
You covered quite a number of issues in that question.
Yes, Maharaj, I mean...
For one thing you covered is the grihasthas are naturally attached.
Yes.
Renunciation, I mean, even attachment has its purpose and its place. But we're not supposed to perpetuate it, that's the point. Parents are naturally attached to children. Children are naturally attached to parents. That's good. That's healthy. That's normal. But it's not eternal. It's not supposed to be eternal. It can't be eternal. And therefore, you're not supposed to progress with it as if it is eternal. It has its place and purpose in different phases of life. And that's why we ask this through given concession for attachment, because that's what they're working with. And by using that attachment for raising children, and of course for charity, which is, you know, acknowledging that there's more children than the ones that take birth from our own womb, then using that attachment, or dovetailing that attachment in the service of the Lord, purifies it. So you're not supposed to, first of all, you can't. And secondly, you're not supposed to try to artificially deny that. That will cause a backslide into deeper attachment. But taking that attachment, and especially at certain phases of life, like the phase of grihastha, and preceding grihastha, there's naturally attachment. Some will just forsake that. That's rare, especially in this age. And it's basically condemned because it's usually going back. Not many are involved with such deep levels of commitment. So attachment is a wonderful thing in its place and in its time. But what I was trying to convey, I'm not really interested in this, forgive me, but what becomes unhealthy is that when you stay beyond that healthy period in an attached condition. So you look at attachment between parents and children. It nourishes life. It gives children life and what they need to be whole, healthy individuals. But you have to let them grow up and mature and go to that life and lead their own lives. So it's a process of, you know, letting go as they mature. You will lead their own lives. Some parents don't like it. They maintain strict control over children. You want to grow up and have their own children. It's unhealthy. That's confining. Or the best analogy is flowing water. It's very clean and pure and healthy. But in a stream where there's a little pool, it's kind of cut off from the flow. It becomes stagnant. But stagnant water is not like that. It's nasty and dirty and filthy and contaminating. All kinds of foul things grow in it. So when our lives cease to flow, I'm saying flow larger than the flow of renunciation, and they become stagnant in areas. And when they become stagnant, they become very unhealthy. So when we become stuck in certain elements of growth, we turn to health. Or when a child is kept stuck, and the parents have no control, they're supposed to be under the parents' control. They need to be under the parents' control in certain phases of life. Some parents don't let go of that. They've got to control them.
is a makes habit in everybody's life. It's just unhealthy. So is it healthy rhythm and flow? At a certain point, attachment is natural and appropriate and helpful to everybody growing up spiritually and emotionally and everything. But then when that phase is entered into another, or like the Native Americans, the Native American Indians see life as four seasons. The first 25 years is like springtime. And what is springtime doing? It's gearing everything up for reproduction and new growth. And then, the seeds are sown. Summer, things grow. And then in the autumn, the leaves turn. In the summer, we look around here, and he's green. You can't tell one tree from another. In the autumn, the chlorophyll recedes, and you see the actual color of an individual tree. It reveals its actual colors. And then it lets its leaves drop, letting go. And then the earth goes into the winter, which is a time for going into internal, introspective, inside, preparing for moving on. So the hostile life is like the junction of spring and summer. A lot of energy. Building and planting the seed for perpetuation of the species. And then in the summer, the plants grow, and in the fall, they're harvested. But if you don't harvest, then you miss the point. So the point is progress.
And then you can. When she was saying after 50 in ISKCON, there seems to be where people still stay together.
Well, that's when people start getting married.
Yeah.
They're attached and you can't anymore.
Because you keep serving. If you're serving, really, if you can help each other to become detached and help each other increase your service, then just like Srila Bhaktivinoda, he didn't leave his family, right?
Well, Srila Prabhupada said there's no need to leave family. If nobody's holding each other back. It tends to be that the attachments hold us back and we have to get away from it. But in pure Vaishnava families, then nobody's holding each other back. They're all helping each other onward. Then there's no need to renounce it. If it's true that nobody's holding each other back.
What happened, I think, in ISKCON is that the people, in the natural order of things, you're supposed to be a student first and get very fixed up in your qualities before you become married. And we didn't do that.
Another big problem.
We didn't
another
do that.
Big problem.
We had no qualities.
I think so.
If it is. It did happen to some degree.
But Krishna saw that that was more important. So Srila Prabhupada knew there was going to be so many difficulties in setting his movement and mission. But the thing that he had faith in, all those problems are temporary. All those problems and the consequences, they're temporary. The benefit is eternal. There are so many of you messing up in so many ways. And Srila Prabhupada just attempted something impossible. But you have to think that all the problems and their consequences are temporary. And that's eternal. Because they're trying to serve, they're trying to chant Hare Krishna, they're trying to preach. Well, that's to everyone's eternal benefit. So for a while, I only got to go through the embarrassments and the sufferings from all the mistakes. That'll be over with in no time. We'll be left with the eternal seed. That's really about the planet. The seed of bhakti in our hearts. The other thing is that even though what Arjuna feared did come to be, because it was Krishna's will, Krishna compensates.
Krishna what?
Compensates. So, because of Srila Prabhupada's will, so Krishna compensates for a lot of the mistakes. Yeah, we'll have to suffer some embarrassments and other ordeals. But Krishna looks at the sincerity. He focuses on that. And he minimizes shortcomings. The other issue about accumulating. The excuses that have been used in Krishna's service should not be rejected. We have to look sincerely, everything that's being accumulated, being used only in Krishna's service. Because that is one of the most misused verses in the scripture. Things used in Krishna's service should not be rejected, so that accumulating more and more Krishna's service. We sometimes mistake what's used for our own pleasure as what's necessary for Krishna's service. I've seen sometimes people confound these two concepts. So this is America, the land of the barbarians. Srila Prabhupada brought the highest, purest culture of the world to cultivate in the lowest, most degraded barbarian place. It's going to be a little awkward for a while. The worst is over. It had to be. It could not be like a smooth transition. That's the question. When the purest form of the absolute meets the most degraded form of the relative, they don't integrate gracefully. There's going to be some complications and some embarrassments, but this is temporary. The benefits are eternal. That's the important thing. It's eternal. So, in no way we're looking down on the natural attachment between parents and children. This has been one of the most frightening things that I've observed in this kind of attitude towards children and mother's relationships with the children. Well, now you see the consequences of that attitude. You try to justify it and rationalize it and sidestep it. Defend their attitudes. Child abuse case was something we couldn't ignore. Krishna made us deal with it, or hopefully we do. Another attachment is there for a reason. Attachments are purified by sacrifice. So by raising children, we get servants. And that sacrifice purifies the attachment. And then it allows us to progress in time. Not hold on to the attachment beyond its proper time. That's the problem. That's where things become stuck.
Thank you.